Tara, and welcome to Sagas and Sass Season 4, brought to you by Geek Saga Entertainment. This is episode 75, and we are continuing, and actually ending, our discussion of Dark Age, the fifth installment of Pierce Brown's Red Rising Saga.
I'm fellow Sagas and Sass host Nick, and this episode covers Lysandre and Darrow's chapters from Pride, Part 4 of Dark Age.
And I'm regular guest host Seth, here to remind you that our Red Rising coverage is spoiler-free outside of the chapters we cover in each episode.
Don't forget that the opinions are those of us as individuals and don't necessarily reflect the opinions of the show as a whole. Well, let's be real, usually we're all on the same page, or at least very close to it.
Last but not least, don't forget to check out our Patreon, which offers tons of ways to support us and receive some great perks in return, including access to the video recordings of these episodes within 24 hours of us recording them and early access to our podcast episodes. You can find us at patreon.com/geeksaga_entertainment.
Lysandre is, of course, still chilling with Glorastes, who has informed him that Darrow's departure from Mercury is imminent, as is apparently Atalantia's attack. Meanwhile, Lysandre has been using Glorastes' servant Exeter as a proxy to communicate with wary loyalists, and while he doesn't like having to do so, he knows that soon he'll be rid of his little monitoring spike and then can apparently do whatever he wants. Basically, some loyalist greens created a clone program for the spike, and then Glorastes delivers the Horn of Helios, a priceless relic that has begun every chariot race in the Hippodrome since it was built. But as Lysandre is preparing himself for the next step in his plan, a servant arrives to tell him he has a visitor. And it's not just any visitor, it's Alexandre O'Arcos and his maidservant. Which is apparently how these assholes think of Rona, and don't even get us started on that. Of course, Lysandre wants them to tell Alexandre that he's indisposed, but the servant reminds him he is on house arrest and that it appears as if he's in the library, so you know, oopsies! This means Lysandre has to rush to the library to pretend that's where he's actually been all this time. But when it comes to Alexandre and Rona paying a visit, there's obviously nothing untoward on their part. They're just thankful for Cato's help in helping Alexandre escape and wanting to show their appreciation, which makes everything that happens next so much worse. Because while Darrow is distracted with trying to crack Atlas, who apparently has some never-seen-before type of neurological conditioning and can sense people through walls or some shit, he also can't shake a nagging feeling about this Cato kid. So when he's not worrying about the Fear Knight, he's, watching Cato sleep? Listen, we're with Thrax, so that's a little creepy. But in the end, the creepiness is worthwhile because Cato murmurs something in his sleep that tips Darrow off. And hey, turns out one of those items on Sevro's trophy wall gets to come back into play because Darrow has Cato's DNA run against the DNA on Octavia's bloody robes, and bingo! The test results show Cato is not the father... Springer flashback, sorry. Oops, not who he says he is. Darrow leaps into action, ordering that Glorastes be found, the EMP he's been building destroyed, and then calling up Alexandre and Rona via their implants to reveal that Cato is, in fact, Lysandre Alun. Dun dun dun! Lysandre has been getting increasingly annoyed with him anyway, as time ticks ever closer to when he needs to leave Glorastes' house. He's having whiny space racist thoughts about Rona, and though he avoids voicing these or his constant disagreements with whatever comes out of Alexandre's mouth, eventually he notices tiny changes in their behavior. Changes that are very obviously in response to the message they receive from Darrow. Lysandre almost immediately moves to attack, smashing Rona into unconsciousness and then holding a gun to her head, before turning it on Alexandre instead, because despite his cousin's offer of a duel, Lysandre is an honorless, racist little punk who shoots Alexandre in cold blood. Honestly, fuck Lysandre, y'all. Especially because Darrow has arrived to find his beloved Lancer mutilated by Lysandre's headshot and his niece unrecognizable thanks to Lysandre's attack, and then has to watch Rona's visceral and heart-wrenching reaction to finding Alexandre dead. But Darrow himself doesn't have time to truly mourn because they need to rev up their grab boots and chase after Lysander. A chase that is cut short when Lysander's face appears not just on every screen throughout the city, but in the dang skyline as well. And then Darkspot appears at the center of the Morning Star, and a tide of darkness rolls out from that spot.
Guess what it is, y'all. Just guess. But you only get one guess. Drum roll, please. It's an EMP, guys. Because it's seriously, like, always an EMP. And that's when Darrow and his friends plummet from the sky. Oh, and Lysander does too, of course, because in his last unknown to him act, Alexander ruined the timing of Lysander's whole thing that was planned, and he didn't get to just land in the Hippodrome like he wanted. Don't worry, though. He makes it there eventually. Double lug. He is buckled into some old Lunese armor, mounts Cicero Alvotum's prized Sunblood, and is soon joined by Calendora, Roan, and the other remaining Praetorians, at which point he blows the Horn of Helios, calling forth mounts for these equestrian soldiers before handing Calendora a razor so that they can reclaim the so-called glory of the society. Cool, 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 cool. Meanwhile, for Darrow, bedlam reigns. The hazardous kind, mind you. Trapped in his dead armor, he's being attacked by a mob of loyalists, high and low color alike, but thankfully a combination of his own brute strength and the help of a small group of Reds allows him to break free. After laying waste to his attackers, he rushes off to find his men, his sling blade-shaped razor scaring off all who see it. He finds Thraxa, and they meet up with Screwface, the other remaining Howlers, and several thousand infantry. Even though they know the city is lost, it appears that the EMP hit the ships in orbit as well, which means it will be a long while before Lysander receives reinforcements from Atalantia. Of course, Darrow knows that Lysander wouldn't be waiting for them anyway. No. He's going for glory, and Darrow outlines a plan. He and Thraxa will hold the Via Triumphia against Lysander while his people hold the rest of the line for as long as they can and retreat through the tunnels to the mound, where they will make their final stand. Members of the scattered Republic legions join Darrow as he and Thraxa work to make the Via Triumphia into a choke point, but their forces are a thin line of resistance against Lysander's masses. Darrow sends snipers up into the buildings with gas rifles in hopes of picking off Lysander, but unfortunately that plot fails, and soon the Sunbloods are bearing down on the center of Darrow's line, and it's an utter massacre. Seriously, people are dying, giant horses are dying, no one has proper armor or technology because of the EMP, but Darrow's biggest problem is that only a fraction of his people are golden obsidian, and he watches as the rest are butchered by the score. And then, he catches sight of Lysander, and Darrow has zero empathy for him, and rightfully so. And knowing that Lysander has to die, Darrow dives into the fray. Only, Darrow isn't the only thing Lysander has to worry about. Reds are literally flinging themselves off rooftops to land amongst Lysander's forces, and while he's distracted by their arrival, who also arrives but Thraxa Autelamonis. She knocks Lysander from his horse and throws him into an apartment building, then proceeds to chase him through the building, busting through walls and other obstacles like the dang Kool-Aid man. Lysander is barely able to fight her off, and just as she is being pulled to safety by some Reds, Roan and some Praetorians surround Lysander in an attempt to protect him from Darrow. That's right, Darrow has finally fought his way close enough to exchange blows with Calendora, who then tries to convince Lysander to let Darrow go, insisting that Lysander is not his equal, except Lysander makes a stand anyway and somehow actually wins the day. What the what? Seriously, he basically jousts with Darrow, who has pulled himself up onto a horse of his own, but unfortunately, Lysander is a rich little bitch who knows more about horsemanship and is able to throw a razor into Darrow's chest and then meet Darrow's sling blade with a second razor, actually shattering the one Darrow is wielding.
Obviously, Darrow has no choice but to retreat, and the only way he's able to reach the safety of the mound is due to the chaos that reigns in the city. Thraxa is already there, and soon Screwface is carried in, though he's in bad condition. And after he's carried off by the medics, Thraxa insists that it's over, here on Mercury and back home. Darrow snaps at her that it's not over, begins gathering those who can still fight, only to have Harnassus put a stop to it. Still, Darrow refuses to give up completely, claiming he hears a ship. Only when he climbs the mound's tower, there's nothing there. Harnassus has followed him and brings Darrow some comfort before heading back down. And once his friend is gone again, Darrow, who has finally relegated himself to the fact that this is the end, pulls out the canister of Lycos soil given to him by Dago, only to feel a gust of air behind him and turn to see, wait for it, Cassius, of all people. And while Lysander has been momentarily distracted by Ajax's arrival and Atlantia's legions are obviously trying to snatch his glory out from under him by moving on the mound, of course the ship that emerges from it catches his eye. He sees Darrow in the open garage bay and knows then that Diomedes lied and Cassius is still alive and that Cassius is now his enemy. Lysander remains at Glorasti's home in Heliopolis to brood on this and plan his triumph. He's wary, and rightfully so, of Atalantia and sees possible treachery around every corner. When he's by her side, he immediately tells her he knows she has assassination plans. But then he pulls a fast one on her by getting down on one knee and proposing a different kind of alliance. Marriage! This keeps her from assassinating him quite yet, and he even gets a good lay out of it. Well, we're all grossed out about this whole thing, considering she was his aunt in every way but blood when he was growing up, is close to 3 decades older than him, and because of, all her other proclivities that have previously been discussed. Not only that, it turns out there's even more awful things to learn about Atalantia. Lysander visits a dying Calendora, who has been poisoned, and so obviously not by Darrow, as Lysander assumes. And the Love Knight has quite a litany of deathbed confessions. Chief among them being that Lysander's parents were reformers, that she and Atalantia planted the bomb that killed them, and that they both sat back while Octavia used the pandemonium chair to divest Lysander of his memories of his parents. So like when Lysander goes to bed with Atalantia, he does so knowing it's with a degenerate who helped murder his parents. Cool, 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 cool. That's fucked. And speaking of degenerates, Lysander's last act in Dark Age is to lay out a feast in the desert to draw in none other than Apollonius of Valii Wrath. Because Lysander needs trustworthy allies, and why wouldn't Apple be at the top of his list to fill that role? Why, yes, that was definitely sarcastic. So yeah, in exchange for Apple's blade and cunning mind, Lysander promises him the chance to take down his enemies, who happen to be the same as Lysander's. Oh, and Lysander is supposedly going to teach him the mind's eye as well. And thus, with an agreement that Apple and Lysander will stand together against the worlds, Dark Age ends. Fuck.
Oh my God. From the very start of Lysander's chapters in part 3, already he's been being just a shit, right? But at this point, he is just tripling down on being a total asshole.
I would like to go for quadrupling.
Quintupling.
There's not a multiple high enough.
Yeah.
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 Yeah. Glorastes is helping him, but also seems to have some doubts, leaving Lysander to think,
he knows the dangers of the path I have chosen to walk, and he doubts me because the old do not remember the necessities of youth. They see only the years on the horizon. They think we are entitled, but we are entitled only to the moment and owe nothing to the future except that we follow our convictions. I am following mine. The desert taught me that the only path is forward.
Ugh. Desert taught me that the only path is forward. Just
everything he does betrays his central conviction.
Yep.
Everything he does, everything he is willing to accept or countenance, hate him.
It's all
flames. So flames on the side of my face.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Speaking of characters we don't like, the Fear Knight's never before seen neurological conditioning, and the fact that he can apparently sense people through walls, that has to be the mind's eye, right?
Well, you know, in that place where they can't get to, that's him looking. No, that's Dune again. I'm sorry. I get so confused.
I mean, Darrow straight up says he can feel Atlas's eyes on him through what is apparently a two-way wall. Not a mirror, it's a wall. Like, Darrow can see through it, but on Atlas's side, it's not a mirror, it's just a straight-up wall. And when Darrow moves left, Atlas's eyes follow. It's bad enough that Lysander this little pixie has the mind's eye, but now we've also got Atlas, Aura, absolutely not a pixie to deal with, who clearly has access to this all-seeing, knowing thing. I'm still confused about how they come about this and what it is, despite the little, I don't want to call it a training montage, but Lysander's like memories of being trained by Octavia in the mind's eye.
I also hate it because it can basically do anything that Pierce wants it to do.
It is the Deus Ex Machina.
Well, other than the Obsidian, but we talked about that last episode. It's just kind of really just want to stand there when he gets captured and just, you know, cut his throat, Darrow, cut his throat, clap, clap, cut his throat.
Yep. Yeah, the Fear Knight especially. I get him leaving Kato alone for I don't even want to say alone. Obviously, they're watching him. So I get him leaving Kato alone for a bit. But Atlas, like, dude, you ain't going to learn anything from this guy.
No.
You know the conditioning these people have against neurological tampering. Yeah, idiot.
Yeah.
Then on the other hand, the weird thing is Darrow is less suspicious, it seems, of Atlas than he is of Kato, who hasn't actually done anything suspicious. So again, we go back to listen to your gut feeling, Darrow. Pay attention to the gut feeling, Darrow, because he's wondering, oh, do I only feel this way? Do I only feel so suspicious about Kato because it is the seeds of fear with a capital F? Is that the only thing that is causing me to linger over Kato's idle days once he goes with Glorastes? Again, Darrow's watching Kato sleep seems a bit much, but good thing is, I guess, creepy, but the good thing is, in the end, it's what finally tips him off, because Kato murmurs truth over all in his sleep, and suddenly Darrow knows he needs to test the kid's DNA against Octavia's bloody robes, because Octavia said the same thing to Darrow before they played the Oracle game in Golden Sun, which, good callback. I am glad that those robes mentioned in the chapter about Severo's chambers actually came back into play. Again, good job, Pierce. But also, oh my God, like, just fuck the fact that Alexander and Rona, I pronounced her name right. No. But also, fuck the fact that Alexander and Rona are with Lysander at the very moment Darrow finally puts two and two together.
I can't believe you pronounced it right and then reread it.
I will never. I will refuse. I will forever refuse to pronounce it correctly. Well, I mean, correctly in
just
terms
of, like Assassinach.
Yeah. I mean, you know, correctly in terms of the audiobook, obviously, like reading it.
Yes.
To me, R-H-O-N-N looks like Hron, not Rhone. Anyway.
That's because it's the Gaelic.
Yeah. Well.
Additional breaking news. Lysander's space racism becomes even more extra obvious. Seriously, the way he thinks about Rona is so fucking gross.
Her name means rough island. How apt. She can't help but be jagged around the edges. Alexander doesn't even notice. He's staring at this rough island like she's the Water Colossus Monument.
Also, yeah, real cool, dude. Trying to couch these thoughts by musing,
their unspoken tenderness seems already so frail to me. Before the Ash Rain, it wouldn't have.
I'm so important and strong and proud, and Rana is the worst, and Alexander is also the worst for liking her.
I'm going to do this a little bit differently. I don't like this miscegenation shaping up between the two of them.
Again, it's so frustrating that Lysander is able to suss out, like immediately able to suss out that they suddenly know his secret, but also just an overall giant what the fuck for him shooting Alexander in the head. I don't care that he didn't think he had time to duel. He's a pussy, and I will never not be angry about this whole situation.
That was the moment that tipped me over. That was the moment there's like, I hope there's no coming back for him. I don't want him to come back. He does not deserve redemption.
Nope.
I was past that point already, but this whole scene is just complete fucking evidence that Lysander is absolute fucking space trash that needs to die.
like talking shit in his head about these two people who are there. Alexander is there to thank him for saving his life. Rana is there because she cares for Alexander and so also wants to thank Lysander, well, Cato, for saving Alexander's life. And it's like, you know why they're there. And this is the way you're thinking about the two of them. And then on top of it, you figure out that they know who you really are, or that they at the very least know you aren't just some random asshole named Cato. And you're just gonna bust Rana's face in and then briefly hold the gun to her head, but then immediately just drop her to the floor and be like, actually, I've got the gun trained on you, Alexander. And then Alexander is like, I will fight you. Let's do this the honorable way. And Lysander's like, nope, no time. Boom. Which is so anti-gold, you know?
It's not expedient for me to hold up the honor of the society now.
That he, exactly. Yep. In this moment, the honor of the society or himself isn't important.
Yep.
I mean, to be honest, I would doubt that it ever is or was. His thoughts in his head is like, the honor of the society, the glory of the society. But then when it doesn't favor what's going to be easiest or best for him, he's like, fuck it.
That's what he tells himself so he can act like he's been victimized and that he should still be important for reasons.
This scene also really makes me upset with Pierce as a writer because it feels like he only created the relationship between Alexander and Rona to have this moment where Alexander could have easily killed Lysander. I think he says it like the tip of his blade is something like a centimeter away from my face and he had to stop it because I put a gun to Rona's head. So the only reason why Lysander isn't dead is because of the relationship that Pierce created between Alexander and Rona. And then you have this whole chapter where Lysander is thinking and acting on all of these like racist, privileged thoughts, and then beats Rona horribly and shoots Alexander in the head. I'm sorry. There's a lot of stuff that I've really liked about the way Pierce has written a lot of things, even things that I was uncomfortable about and didn't like that they happened. I still felt like it was good writing. This, I think, is just fucking terrible. It is hard for me to get past that.
I mean, I realize that ultimately writing, especially the kind of writing that Pierce is doing, fiction writing in general, you're creating characters for us to care about. So we attach to them and we want to read more about them. But this really does feel like he created this relationship and he made them cinnamon rolls just so he could do this at this point.
And so you could have that moment of almost Lysander's downfall, but Lysander uses this magic mind's eye that has no limits on what it can do.
How many of those does he get in this book? 6, 8, 12?
So fucking many, dude. So fucking many. It's obscene. There's a lot of stuff where it's like, okay, he's really good at observing people and seeing all these different like little ticks and things.
He's really good at describing people.
And then making intellectual leaps from there. But then there's stuff that's just like, this is fucking ridiculous. I think it compounds how much I fucking hate Lysander because he's just a shitty character. And then to give him this shitty superpower is fucking terrible. Like, you shouldn't have done that, Pierce. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
You shouldn't have.
I don't disagree with you, but I also think it's the only way Lysander would have survived this long.
I agree, but then the argument is, like, why do you have Lysander in the first place?
Yeah.
Other than to give a POV character from the other side. And you could have done that with a different character who is more interesting or more complex than just a little shit.
And it's like, we don't like the other side anymore. We don't think they have any valid points. No matter how Lysander keeps listing the things that they should do right, we don't like him. Yeah, what is the point of him in these novels? Yeah, like, if it's making me want to throttle someone, he's doing a really good job.
I'm with you, Seth. I'll be really pissed off if Pierce tries to give him a redemption arc.
Oh, he is.
And I feel like that's what he's setting it up for, and I don't think it's going to work.
He's
because I don't think you can redeem somebody who has done all of this horrible shit.
The only way I'll even consider it is if he doesn't live.
Yes. Sort of like a Darth Vader situation.
Yeah.
Like if he self-sacrifices at the end somehow
to give Darrow the win. Yeah. Grabs baby Jackal and jumps into an atomic furnace or something like that. I don't know.
One of the things when he beats Darrow, that situation, that was well written because it makes sense. Lysander, a child who was raised among the Oriat would know how to ride. And Darrow, mm-hmm. as we know from the first book, Red Rising, doesn't even like horses. So like it makes sense that Lysander would have that skill, and therefore in that specific situation with Darrow already just beaten down and weak from fighting, would be able to injure him the way he did. That is believable based on Lysander's past versus Darrow's past. It's not his magic mind's eye. It is something that is a believable thing. But also, mind's eye or not, I think the thing is that really deep down, he might say, I don't have time, but really, I don't think Lysander would have beat Alexander.
No.
No, he wouldn't have.
Which is why he shot him instead. Which is why he is the fucking...
The worst.
Worst.
And then Darrow finding Alexander dead and his niece, Rana, beaten up is one thing. But honestly, it's Rana's reaction to seeing... Yeah, shut up. to seeing Alexander's body that guts me every time.
Particularly as Darrow's thoughts say so much when she falls to her knees beside the body and her scream tears me to tatters. How many years did they stand apart from each other behind me? How many precious few moments were they honest with each other? They were robbed of so much joy, promised it, then robbed again.
So is it right to say that Alexander was fridged?
No, because, well, I mean, unless Rona becomes the Punisher now. Ish.
I would fucking love that for her, honestly.
Yeah.
I love that for her.
If it gives her so much woman pain that she needs to motivate her on her journey, then...
That's the other part of the trope.
Yeah.
You have to kill them off
in order to give the male character impetus.
Like, honestly, Uncle Ben was fridged. There are two people in a relationship, and one of them dies to give the other one, in this case specifically, man pain to continue his journey. It's just that they're not in a romantic relationship. That's the only difference from the trope.
I think to say that it has to be a woman dying to give a man pain and then to further his story is... a little bit basic, honestly. That tends to be the way it goes. Or
that is just the trope.
Yeah. Right. Well, I mean, at the time, Gail Simone, I think it was, who invented the term, was making a point about how women are treated in comics and comic storytelling.
Yeah.
And it was a specific reference to a specific comic where
Green Lantern.
Yeah.
The early Kyle Rayner issues where he's like, I don't want to be Green Lantern. And Major Force is like, I'll put your girlfriend in a refrigerator in this Comics Code approved comic.
Honestly, bless Gail Simone for that, for all of that.
Gail Simone is fucking incredible.
Amazing.
By the way, if you'd like another take on girls in refrigerators, you can get the refrigerator monologues.
Oh, my God.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, it's thinly disguised versions of some of the most famous fridgings in comics in the afterlife yelling about it.
I just love the title. It's very reminiscent of the Vagina Monologues. And I'm hoping that it reads like the Vagina Monologues.
I've never read the Vagina Monologues, so I don't know. But I did enjoy the Refrigerator Monologues.
I mean, the Vagina Monologues isn't necessarily meant to be read. It's meant to be seen.
Yeah.
I've actually, I produced and then directed and ended up having to perform in the Vagina Monologues back in college. So one of my actors dropped out 2 days beforehand, and I had to monologue the See You Next Tuesday monologue. So that was fun. Which is like, I don't mind it, right? I get it. It's let's take back the bad word, right? But if I was going to have to memorize any monologue from that show and perform it on stage 2 days before we went live, it wouldn't have been that one ever. Anyway, a little bit about me. I want a Sunblood, don't you?
Yes.
Although I will say, kind of like, what the fuck kind of name is Blood of Empire? What the fuck kind of name is that for a horse? Because I've had purebred horses and they always have ridiculous names. Okay. That is a thing. It's like with purebred dogs too, right? They always have a stupid name that you register. And hopefully you're not an idiot who calls them by that name and also adopt, don't shop. But Blood of Empire. What the fuck? And I know that these horses are carved, but this horse is described as having orange eyes to match an orange mane and tail. Yet he is a dappled gray horse. Meh. Orange eyes? Ew. Also, orange on gray? Ew.
I mean, easy to pick out in a crowd. Also, kind of hilarious that Darrow recalls the same visit we heard Cicero relate to Lysander earlier in Dark Age and thinks about how terrifying Sunbloods are, though at the same time he feels kinship with that unnatural bloodline, as they and he are both apparently beautiful monsters made for one purpose, and that purpose is killing. Anyway.
Apparently, because normally horses aren't made for killing, but these giant horses, they will bite your head off, I guess, if you get on their wrong side. Because even when Lysander approaches Blood of the Empire, whatever the fuck his name is, it's stupid. The obsidians that are caretakers for the Sunbloods are just, oh my gosh, yes, you are the best, Lysander. You are the Lord, because the Sunblood doesn't bite his head off. Like, he's able to get the horse to kind of bow to him a little bit, like the hippogriffs in Harry Potter, as much as I hate making a Harry Potter reference.
I just have to look. Was Cassius making a point to keep up with Lysander's equestrian training for the last 10 years?
No.
I'm just saying is all. Maybe the mind's eye helped him do it. Maybe with the mind's eye, you can remember skills you haven't practiced in a decade as easily as those you practiced today.
Okay, so to be fair, as somebody who took horseback riding lessons from age like 8 to 13... And then I had a couple years where I didn't. And then I had my own horse and I didn't show, but I rode and was caretaker for the horses for several years before I went away to college. My family still had horses for a long time. And I would go back like 5 years later and it's like riding a bike. Cliche, but I'm...
All right.
I will say that. I will say that.
To me, it was another example of Lysander being like, I haven't been on a horse in 10 years, but I'm still better than this red. And I'm like, it's like, come on.
Again. Well, Darrow was legitimately like scared of horses.
Yes. I mean, and he should have been like, they're the pure blood or the Sunbloods as they're describing them are war horse. They're like freaking Clydesdale sized.
Oh, they're bigger than that.
Yeah.
And he was scared of the little quote-unquote 16 hand horses that they had at the institute, which is also funny because compared to how tall Golds are, so 16 hands for a horse is actually like an above average sized regular horse. Unless you have a thoroughbred, they can reach about 17 hands, maybe a little more, and of course the Clydesdales and stuff are bigger, but 16 hands is pretty big for a horse, and for a 7 foot tall person to be riding them would basically look like me riding a pony.
Out of curiosity, because I don't know, are hands measured horizontally or vertically?
So it's horizontally, but generally it's 4 inches. So it's based on like a larger hand.
Yeah.
So, and it's measured to their withers where the neck meets the back. So the head of the horse is much taller than that, depending on how long their neck is, whatever. But like, yes, from ground to withers is how you measure the hands. I had a horse in high school who was 15.1 hands and she was barely big enough for me. And I'm 5'8" and a half.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And we had a thoroughbred who was 17 hands who was like, I felt comfortable riding that horse. It was way better for me than the little 15 hand girl that I rode for a long time, but he was also a sweet boy. Anyway, moving on. What's what in Heliopolis? Why, Hazard Bedlam, according to Screwface. He tells them the whole city is a mess. Ships are a mess too. Strong points are solid, but there's shuttles down all over the city. We got half the pack looking for you. Been sending out teams for them and bringing the wounded back here.
Screwface nods to the wounded at the far side of the market as the rest of the Howlers form a semicircle around Darrow. And for a moment, Darrow feels as if he's back at the Institute, though he notes that of the Howlers, only Screwface still has the stink of dead horse about him.
I mean, literally.
Yeah, and not for the first time, Darrow feels thankful for his peculiar education because he knows what to do when the lights go out.
You know, that's something that I think is kind of passed over a lot, but is probably really important. With the whole ha ha ha, yes, it's always an EMP, y'all. But for real, that is something that their institute education was good for.
Yeah.
Real quick note, we get a sighting of Lyria's brothers. They're not named, but it's very obvious because there's three of them. Two of them look alike. So it's her two blood brothers and her brother-in-law, because they all have the same exact accent. And they're apparently Rat Legion snipers, and Darrow gives them special rifles and sends them up into the buildings to hopefully shoot Lysander. Just to move forward a little bit, we know that at least one of them survives, possibly two. It's a little bit vague because after the battle, there are two like quick passages, lines, whatever, that make it confusing as to whether it's one or two of the three snipers who lived, because Darrow notes that Thraxa and Red Sniper are waiting for him at the mound. And soon after that, he's talking to Harnassus and he says, one of the Red Snipers I sent after Loon joins us, a nasty wound on the side of his head. So it sounds like two of the three survived. We don't know, considering he only sent three Red Snipers, the references were way too obvious for them to not be Lyria's two brothers and her brother-in-law. It sounds to me like two of them survived, because to say just Thraxa and the Red Sniper, and then literally like a page and a half at most later, one of the Red Snipers I sent after Loon joins us, a nasty wound. Like, you would have think he would have noted the nasty wound before. Nothing has changed. Anyway, so there's a lot of argument in the fandom about how many of Lyria's brothers survived or if any of them did. I believe it's two. That's all I'm saying on the matter. Now, speaking of Reds, I guess that term blood red that we heard much earlier in the book is the best way to describe what happens with Darrow when he sees Lysander fighting.
Darrow thinks, I see it so clearly. All is life before him, all the worlds on their knees, rejoicing their return supplication as they embrace their chains so long as pretty manicured hands hold the lead. His rise will summon a hideous tide of renewed romantic vigor that will not stop until my people, my wife, my child are swallowed whole. And then he will smile from the humble throne that war built and say he is their good shepherd. I gave him a choice long ago, a chance to live in peace, but he has returned to war. To see the boy become man scours the empathy in me. 10 years too late, he must die. I shave my razor from its long form to the sling blade. The dread monster rises in the belly of me. Laughter spews from between my teeth. I would die for the truth that all men are created equal, but in the kingdom of death, amidst the ramparts of bodies and wind all of screams, there is a king. And his name is not Loon. It is Reaper. Which is a really bad ass thing to say, considering what happens. He should have killed at least 20 people by hand after that. Perhaps cutting limbs off some of them and beating the others to death with those limbs, with that kind of...
Unfortunately, very soon after that, he's knocked off of his feet by Kalindor's horse.
Lysander's thought... As he falls, his red acrobatics shine. No one falls like the Reaper. It's just kind of funny. Like,
no one falls like the Reaper.
No one falls like the Reaper. His red acrobatics shine.
To be fair, Darrow literally takes out Kalindor's horse as he's falling and then removes her from the fight as well with some pretty grievous wounds. But also, no one falls like the Reaper. How would you even know, Lysander? What you been doing these past 10 years?
He's been watching them clips on YouTube.
Like him.
Yeah. He's been watching Darrow play Minecraft. Oh, God. Anyway... I mean, as you said, Seth, the whole thing that happens next when Lysander, and I already mentioned this, Lysander being like, ha ha ha, I'm better on horses than he is. So he's riding. They're basically jousting. He like flings one razor at Darrow. I get that. But the thing that shocks me is that he meets Darrow like hand on hand or whatever, razor on razor. And Lysander is somehow so strong that he shatters the razor that Mustang gave to Darrow. Like, that we've seen them fight with razors so much and we have never heard of a razor being shattered before.
Yeah,
and I don't believe that Lysander is actually that strong. Is it just the horse's momentum? Like,
there's absolutely no way that Lysander should be that strong, because we know that he is emaciated from his time in the desert.
Mm-hmm. Which Darrow isn't in the best of shape either, but I have to imagine that it's just Lysander knows how to ride, and so he knew like how to put more oomph behind what he was doing, and also that maybe his horse was better. Blood of Empire is the prize stallion or whatever.
Also, both blades shatter. It's not just Darrow's.
True, but still, we've never heard.
I mean, yes, still, it seems ridiculous. Before. And I found that part a little like the trick of throwing the one blade that Dara didn't see into his chest. Yep, that was a good move. The razor shattering and that whole thing, I was like, no, that doesn't.
Because if Darrow had a fully functioning razor, he would have killed him right there. And then, so this is another reason why I don't like this. It's another unearned Lysander escape.
Yeah, because Darrow was still mounted. Lysander wasn't.
He should have been dead. He should have been dead so many times in the last 5 minutes.
Yep. And I also expected Darrow to like pull the razor in his chest out and use that to ride down Lysander. But whatever, it's fine.
I think the problem with that is, or with him like just pulling out the razor and trying to ride Lysander down, is like it was such a route that even if he was able to catch Lysander, everything still would have been fucked. And then there's still the Praetorians and everything. They're still so outnumbered. Darrow knew in that moment that he had to retreat, which is not a Darrow thing to do, but in this particular instance, kind of grateful that he did, even if what I guess he thought he could go back to the mound where everybody was gathering and just gather up the people who were still able to fight and go back. But then Harnassus is like, no, 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 you can't do that. And Darrow realizes he has to actually listen to Harnassus for once. The conversation that he has with Harnassus after that is honestly just so great. Like, yes, it's sad, but it's probably one of the better back and forths in this book, because previously they were at such odds with each other. But it turns out that that was probably more because Darrow was shying away from Harnassus's disapproval as the man had become something of a father figure to him.
Darrow looks at the body the carver made for him and says, you know the curse of this world? The greatest gifts were given to the worst of us.
But Harnassus replies, not realizing they are gifts is what makes them the worst.
Darrow then thanks Harnassus for being his conscience, because my wife says I sometimes need that. I know it isn't an easy role.
Harnassus laughs, but what a role. What a role.
I like that they became buds in the end. I feel like they probably had a decent repertoire prior to like the Iron Rain and Orion being captured and then Harnassus like ordering all the forces back to Luna or whatever, because he was also ordered to do that by the Senate. So he just complied with what he was told to do. But there were a lot of hints that Harnassus was necessary in this book, whereas in Iron Gold, you read what he did and you're just like, ugh. I like that Mustang apparently always saw that Harnassus was Darrow's conscience, and Darrow finally recognizes that he needed that. And Harnassus is like, yeah, I'm cool with it. We're good here. Then they part ways, and Darrow is just like, well, guess this is the end. And he pulls out his little jar of dirt. He pulls out his jar of dirt from Dago, and it's kind of like, and holy fuck. Cassius's arrival, though, it's just so very Cassius, a gust of air, and then, oh gods, brooding again. Some things never change. Because, by the way, we talked about that in our last episode when Kavix mentioned sending someone to collect Darrow. It was Cassius all along.
I don't know how many messages I sent to you about this, but I know it was more than one where I'm like, he's not dead. He's not going to let him die off screen. That's just, absolutely ridiculous. Although I will say now, an author I quite like a lot did in fact kill a character I quite like a lot off screen before the action of his current book started. And I'm really pissed about that. So, don't let your good characters have off screen deaths.
Yeah. Characters die off screen, off page all the time. But no, I mean, obviously I read Iron Gold, actually before it came out, and then Dark Age was like a year and a half later. And I never actually believed Cassius was dead. He was too prevalent of a character in the main series, and even more prevalent in Iron Gold through Lysander's POV for him to be dragged away and not even die off page, but It was like he was dragged away for sure, possibly deathly injured from the duels that he fought on Io. But for Lysander to find out that he's quote unquote dead by just some rando coming to his room and being like, knock, knock. Sorry, Lysander, Cassius is dead.
Yeah, Candygram for Mongo.
Yeah, no. But still, when he does return, it's just, like I said, it's just so Cassius. His ship has like super extra amazing cloaking devices and just flies down into Heli- and also wasn't hit by the big bad EMP and lands on the mound right behind Darrow as he's about to just give it all up. And it's just Cassius strutting out. Oh, gods, brooding again. Nothing perfect ever changes, Darrow. It's so good.
The timing is impeccable for other reasons, too. As mere moments before the Archimedes flies off with Darrow on board, Lysander was thinking,
I did not beat the Reaper. I simply hit him when he was down. The legends of our age die one by one like autumn leaves, and when they are gone, will we be lesser for their absence? It seems cheap. With his like death imminent, the world seemed emptier. Almost as cavernous as they did when Cassius fell. One by one, the titans of my youth disappear. And freed from their shadow, I do not feel liberated. I feel bereft. Nothing is permanent. No one escapes. The bill comes at the end, I whisper.
Which is so just like he whispers to himself, the bill comes at the end. Fuck you.
Like, what the fuck, bro?
You know what? Dramatic. I just want to play him like the Jack Burton monologues from Big Trouble in Little China and be like, this man is a farce. He is a parody of a person. That is the point of his character. Now, say what you said again.
Well, and then minutes, maybe less later, Lysander sees the Archimedes escaping from the mound with Darrow, who is super visible in the ship's open garage bay, because of course he has to mock his enemies with his escape. Do not disagree with that at all, that he did that because he needed them to see that he was escaping.
Yep.
Because he needed word to spread that he didn't die. They didn't need another Morningstar situation where they killed a gold who looked just like Darrow, right? He needed them to know that he was still alive. But whoa, Lysander's just like, oh, there he goes. And he's so big mad about Cassius. I would have given anything for him to live, but not this.
Yeah. Fucking shit, man.
Except you spent 10 years with Cassius. You had to have known that he would never... Wait, okay, let me even backtrack. You spent 10 years with Cassius, and then he literally, as far as you knew, gave his life to prevent the Rim from going to war with the Republic. And you still are thinking, I would have given anything for him to still be alive, but not this. Lysander, you dumb.
This is why I think there's no real way to redeem this character. Mm-hmm. Because if you're basically father figure, at least brother, who literally saved your life, comes back from the proverbial dead, and all you can think is, not like this. Fuck you, bro. Like, just die.
Yeah, what I really hope is we're setting him up for a death that is going to break the Core Rim Alliance apart. Because otherwise, it's just going to be difficult for Darrow and everybody to, you know, really lick the rim.
Oh.
Oh, yes.
That's a great point.
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
That's a great point.
Well, Darrow leaves. Lysander goes back to hanging out with Glorastes, and they're planning his triumph, which, I don't know. There was that whole night of terror. They didn't call it that, but whatever. There's the whole like night or day or whatever. There's this whole time period where they just basically ran around murdering all the rising soldiers that they could find. And the only thing Lysander has to do with any of it is like, oh, cool, they're all gone now. And now I'm just hanging out with Glorastes again. And we're going to plan my triumph. Then he gets all annoyed with Glorastes because it's too much that there are loon crescents painted on every street corner from the Hippodrome to the spaceport. And I'm pissed off at Glorastes right now. I kind of get where he comes from in some ways. He is obsessed with Lysander, and he was mad at Darrow for the thing that happened with Orion and the Stormbreakers. Fine, whatever. But when Lysander is whining to him about there being too many loon crescents on the street corners, Glorastes tells him, "You're projecting frustration, dear boy. Desist. I am the artist. If it is to be a diva duel, I'll match you cry for cry and then piss on your pillow and blame it on my dead ocelot. And you'll wonder if I'm insane and I'll cackle because yes, yes, I am. And I can get away with anything." Now, I got two things to say here. First of all, how dare you try to reflect Cavex in this speech by Glorastes? Second, possible Archer reference alert with the ocelot bit. Have either of you watched Archer?
It's been a while, but I did watch a bunch of it. Yes, I stopped watching during the season where they're on an island smuggling things.
Yeah, I haven't watched in a long time either. Cheryl, though. Cheryl is like the rich girl, and she she has a pet ocelot. And I just was like, who the fuck would think of throwing in why ocelot? That has to be an Archer reference. I refuse to believe it isn't.
Lysander reminds him that Atalantia could still kill him, but Glorastes claims his head is more secure than Lysander's because he is the best kind of hero, harmless, while Lysander is the worst kind, young with a name.
Which is why he actually probably has stuff to fear from Atalantia, who later asks him during the triumph if it is better to be feared than loved. And listen, of course I know that this is an oft-repeated question in history, literature, whatever, but I can't be the only one feeling the strong, like, Cersei Sansa vibes here, right?
Is it because of the age difference and because the older one might screw someone inappropriate?
Both.
Yes.
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 Anyway, Lysander's response is to propose to Atalantia, telling her, "You are feared. I am loved. What better marriage could one hope for?" Because he had to undermine her to save Heliopolis, and doing so made them enemies in her mind, validating the suspicions Ajax and others have probably been voicing to her. Obviously, Lysander doesn't love Atalantia, but duty first, apparently.
Oh, and this whole thing is also why he hadn't been to visit Kalindor yet. She is dying from a poison that Lysander assumes was from Darrow's blade, which... I hate to use the word obviously again so soon, but which is obviously a stupid assumption because that's not Darrow's MO. And with what Lysander learns from Kalindora when he goes to visit her, combined with what we know of Atalantia, isn't it fucking obvious again that she's the one, Atalantia is the one who poisoned the Love Knight? Because as we mentioned in the summary, Kalindor also confesses to Lysander that she was party to the murder of his parents. Atalantia knew that Kalindora was already pushing for Lysander. I mean, she brought the Praetorians into the mix in the first place. So Atalantia had to have assumed that Kalindora was at some point going to admit that they both helped plant the bomb that killed Lysander's parents. On top of that, Kalindor also knew that Atalantia didn't care that Octavia used the pandemonium chair to make Lysander forget his parents. I just want to give like a kind of minor shout out to Aja, because like, listen, we all hate her because she killed Ragnar and was a huge space racist. But at the same time, she was the only one in this whole inner circle of Octavia's that protested what Octavia did with the pandemonium chair.
Yeah, also, hey, my Damie, that's the society you're trying to uphold. The one that made you forget your parents because it was more convenient.
Yep, yep. And then he learns all of this from Kalindora and sees Atalantia weeping at Kalindora's funeral, which takes on like a whole new cast once you know all these things, you know? Like, Lysander, take a step back here. Take a step back. But he doesn't. He doesn't.
Nope.
Because in the aftermath of the battle, and after learning all of this shit, and even seeing Atalantia weep, I don't believe Atalantia actually has feelings, but after seeing Atalantia weep at Kalindor's funeral, I mean, maybe he doesn't know that she's the one who probably poisoned her, but still, whatever. Lysander believes he has finally learned the rules his grandmother once aimed to teach him, or rather now understands that there are no rules, which, like, I roll.
He believes he is living in a time of great opportunity. And while his thoughts on this are long, we wanted to share the whole passage to show you what a little shit he really is. He muses,
"That sense of insignificance and guilt I permitted Cassius to instill within me has not disappeared, but the remains in the back of my mind is a reminder of the fate one can accept if he lets the mercy of others define him. Darrow's mercy all those years ago, Cassius's mercy in serving as my protector, Calendora's last testament, all of it rooted in some vain attempt to rekindle honor they long ago sacrificed for one reason or another. The same honor Lorne preached after painting a legend in blood. The same selfish honor Romulus preserved before abandoning his people at their most dire hour. The same honor that led to my engagement with Atalantia and let me delude myself into thinking that honor was about personal sacrifice. My grandmother was the most cunning person I ever met, but still, she is wrong. She thought there was no place for honor in the world. I cannot agree completely. It was her cruelty that chipped away at the foundation of her power and poisoned all who served her. It is Atalantia's cruelty which makes me pray to people like her. Is it honorable to kill her for my mother? Honorable to thrust us into civil war? Honorable to fulfill my pledge to submit to her every whim? Honorable to be trapped between her legs night after night so that gold might have unity? I think not. I think, as with all things, honor is best appreciated in moderation, as is cruelty."
Listen, I guess a big Lysander diatribe about honor and cruelty in moderation is a great lead-in to Apple's return and Lysander's ensuing alliance with him.
I don't know. I got my eyes stuck on that last big eye roll after listening to that.
I was like, every time he said honor, every time he said honorable, 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 it's like, I cannot, can I, if I roll my eyes one more time, will they just stick there in the back of my head?
Yeah.
I'm looking at the sky.
It's like, honor is not about personal sacrifice. Isn't it though? Really? Okay.
Well, we know he
also
has
just
no
constantly
honor.
Contradicts himself, so yeah, whatever.
Yeah. And we know he has no honor because of how he killed Alexander, so fuck him. Anyway, speaking of that big diatribe leading into his alliance with Apple, as awful as Apollonius is, am I the only one that still also feels disgusted with him for allying with Lysander? Like, dude, someone as awful as you are, Apollonius, I mean, you can do better than Lysander. Like, he's bad. He's awful. But, like, he doesn't have that, like, two-faced, like, he's awful in a singular way, right? And I don't know. I know he just wants to kill Darrow and a whole bunch of other people, but, and their enemies are the same and all that, but and I guess it doesn't really matter because I don't really see this alliance. I never saw this alliance going well for either one of them.
Yep.
Because they're
bad. Yeah.
Apollonius has a one-track mind and Lysander is apparently all over the place. I am all about the glory of the society and honor, but also honor is best appreciated in moderation and cruelty is also allowed in moderation. Cool, dude. I know we use the cool thing a lot, but listen, I will never not I'm sorry not sorry. That line / gif from Brooklyn Nine-Nine is so apt for so many of these Red Rising situations.
Yep.
So many of them having to do with Lysander.
Yep, most of them, honestly.
Yep.
Unfortunately, we have some deaths to talk about. So, in memoriam.
A metric fuckton of Darrow's legions, likely including at least one of Lyria's brothers.
Calendora Al'Saan, who could and should have lived through the Battle of Mercury were it not for the fact that she was totally poisoned by Atalantia, not Darrow.
Alexander Arkos, who had a great character arc, was developing a really nice relationship with Rona, and then Lysander shot him in cold fucking blood, and Lysander doesn't even have a millionth of the honor that Alexander had, despite his desperate fucking need to feel like he has any sort of honor. Fuck you, Lysander. Alex, my Alex. Die in a fire.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Or somewhere more painful and more humiliating. Die in a sewer.
Or get your body burned and your ashes spread in a sewer, like with the senators.
Don't put him with the martyrs of the day of the Red Doves.
Very true. God damn it.
Okay. No. We'll put him in a public restroom in the worst part of town.
And just paralyze him so he's still conscious, but is completely immobilized while people defecate on his face.
I mean, his I wasn't going to go quite that far.
Oh God, this is now sounding like God. What's that horror movie?
Human Centipede.
Yes, that one. Lysander's fate is more like Barbarian. Have you guys seen Barbarian?
No, I haven't. It's on my list of need to see, though.
Oh, okay. So, God, I won't spoil it then. But for anybody who is listening who has seen Barbarian, that's the fate I want for Lysander. Not the very end result, but what happens elsewise. And if you've seen it, hopefully you'll know what I'm talking about. If you don't, you can always contact us and ask me what the fuck I'm talking about. But if you've seen the movie, I think you'll know what I'm talking about. But honestly, rip Alexander. He deserved better, especially after we thought he was dead previously in Darrow's chapters. And then he came back and it was fucking Lysander who saved him, only to shoot him in the head. Fuck you, Lysander.
Yep. Fuck you, Lysander. Fuck you, Pierce.
Well, maybe not fuck you, Pierce. I mean, I don't
He's the one who wrote it. Fuck him.
It's from the bottom of my heart.
From the bottom of my heart. We love your writing. Fuck but you. Fuck... No, I don't feel that way. But
fuck you, Lysander.
I'm still upset about it. Yeah. As we close out the episode, we just want to give a shout out to our heroes, your patron, Tommy of the TKOK Podcast Network. Thank you so much for supporting us once again. I'm Tara, along with fellow host Nick and practically permanent guest host Seth. Don't forget that you can always hit us up at Sagas and Sass on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter, or email us at sagasandsass@gmail.com with any comments or thoughts you might have, including questions about what I meant about the Barbarian reference. Our current schedule has us hopefully recording some episodes about the Red Rising graphic novels prior to the release of book 6, but also as Lightbringer's release date approaches, do not forget to check out the summaries of books 1-5 that we have been / will share on sagasandsass.com. Please consider supporting us at patreon.com/GeekSaga_entertainment for early access to our recordings.
Thank you for listening to the Sagas and Sass podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter at Sagas and Sass.